Got to say, I remember, Kevin, some years ago, there was a guy who, he was a well-known Christian author, and he used to write a little piece at the end of Christianity Today, just a little. His name was Philip Yancey, you remember him? But he told about how he grew up in some town and he wasn't a believer, but he had friends who were believers, and so they'd be invited to different churches and he'd go to them. But he always, and forgive me here, I'm a Baptist, but you know it's the same ilk. He said he finally wound up at the Baptist church because they had the best food and the best looking girls. So something else he'd do pretty well too. But all right, well, listen, we're going to pick it up where we left off last night. Let me just rehearse real quickly. First of all, I'm going to take you, although it's not going to show up yet. But let me remind you of that verse that I took you to in Exodus 19. All right, just real quickly. What's at stake is that, hold on here, I'm putzing. So we're talking about, we start out by talking about progressive revelation, and then point of fact, God has carefully and lovingly parceled out the truth concerning himself in seasons of revelation, and that takes us through a greater and greater level of mankind. Remember each one of those stages of divine revelation we can call a dispensation, if you don't mind, but the word simply means stewardship, and that's exactly what it is. We are stewards of truth, And as it says in 1 Corinthians 4, that it is required of a steward that he be found faithful. So we're going to be held accountable for our faithfulness to what he has revealed to us. But we said that you have a remarkable giant step in progressive revelation as you pass from the Old Testament to the New Testament. And I just think perhaps it would, my thought in putting this together, I think there is benefit and profit in understanding is kind of laying out the distinction between where mankind was in the Older Testament. Now, you know that the first 39 books of your Bible we refer to as the Old Testament. Testament is another word for covenant. And I like to say that basically the Old Testament, those 39 books. What am I doing wrong up there, you guys? Anything or... Not plugged in. Huh? Oh, he said unplug it. Oh, okay, good idea. That's what he said. I don't hear. Yeah. What? So far, no good. But that's all right. We can get along without it, too. But let me go back to it. So we have these 39 books. I like to refer, I think it's good. As a matter of fact, Larry Pettigrew refers to the New Testament as God's manual for living under a new covenant set of blessings. And the old covenant is, in fact, Lucas, have at it. Here's the thing. The old covenant, what is the old covenant? Well, it's the Sinaitic covenant. Or the law, as the Bible calls it again and again. Now, curiously, we refer to that Old Testament period, the historical period, as the Old Covenant, the Old Testament. But think about this. I know most of you are very familiar with this, that by the most conservative, and I would regard most biblical chronology, creation happened about 4,000 B.C., right? About 6,000 years ago. The Old Testament closes about 400 years before Christ. That's Malachi, Nehemiah, then 400 years, right? So the Old Testament covers from in the beginning God created until I will send you Elijah before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. It from 4,000 to 400. So about 3,600 years, right? Have I done my arithmetic? But when was the old covenant given? Moses. About 1400 B.C. So most of the history recorded in our old covenant didn't happen under the old covenant. The old covenant wasn't... Does that make sense to you? The law was only given late in that period that we refer to as the Old Testament. And even that, I won't get back into it because I'll get lost. But even that, you got the progress of Revelation. We rehearsed some of it last night. So you've got the 1900 years before God chooses Abraham, and then you got the patriarchal period, and then you've got the sojourn in Egypt and so on. And of course, as they come out of the sojourn in Egypt, God gives them the law. That's Exodus 19. And what are we doing wrong, do you think? Sometimes, forgive me, you guys, we can get along without this, but as long as we're messing, that's yours, and it's fairly new, I think, isn't it? If they fail, you might just try a different one. Oh, no, it's the wrong thing. Never mind. But anyway, the point is that you have this 39 books which describe God's dealings with Israel up until the coming of Christ, well, up until Malachi, then 400 years. And then you have this record of God's revelation of himself through, by the way, through, first of all, the living word Jesus, and then through the apostles who record and interpret the life of Jesus and introduce us to the age in which we live, which is the New Testament age. So we're going to contrast that old covenant with the with life under the new covenant. That's where we're headed. And all right, so let me take you to your notes, because we can do this easily. And go to page 3. And all right, let me rehearse. So he said, I think it works for me to conceive of, if we can talk about ways in which, I thought I had a flash there, ways in which, well, what I call it is seven concepts that I think kind of overview the distinctive ways in which God was dealing with Israel in the Old Testament. What God was doing to and through Israel, for and through Israel in the Old Testament. And I start out with number one. You can see it on your sheet there. The intent and importance of Israel's influence. And the point is, this is what we said last night, that God was in no sense abandoning Israel, the rest of the world in choosing Israel. Then in point of fact, he was forming that covenant relationship in order to put himself powerfully on display to the nations. And to that end, we looked at these two very pivotal verses. One in Genesis chapter 12, where God, at the calling of Abraham, says, "You are going to be a blessing to all the nations." So he's not neglecting anybody. And then in Exodus 19, you have that marvelous passage, that twofold phrase where God says, "I'm going to make you, first of all, a kingdom with a priestly function," right? So I'm going to minister myself to the nations. And secondly, I'm going to make you a holy nation, set apart. You're going to be distinct. One of my favorite authors is, now don't move, stay right there. Huh? That's right. Yeah, you got something going on there. Man, yes, we just got a bad connection there. For whatever set of reasons. Huh? All right, now we got trouble. Oh, yeah, you had to do it up there. He's smarter than I am. All right, so now, here's the question. And so the question for the house that is really distinct, and we got to work, you got to kind of take yourself, you know, you got to work at this, is to contemplate, the Bible is quite clear about it, but it's so foreign to us, exactly how it is that God had determined to put himself on display. What are what is the strategy? What do you think? Can I mess with this? I'm the guy who did that. I don't know, maybe that was stupid, but I was trying to take the pressure off of that. There you go. Houston, we have contact, but not for long. I switched on. All right, so go to number 2. And we said that key to God's strategy to use Israel in that regard, Luke, you're a genius, is geography. And first of all, and on two counts. And first of all, what we called, number two here, the principle of providential placement. I'm going to pick it up right there. And the idea is by the reason that the God very deliberately shaped the face of the earth. And he shaped it in such a way that Israel lies in the midst of the nations and that the travel in the ancient world made its way. By the way, let me recommend a book to you if you're interested in things Israel. And if you're not, shame on you. But that's another question. But there's a book called The Bible and the Sword by a very, very, an unusual historian. And she's unusual in this regard. She can write. Most historians, oh my goodness. But she is an excellent author. Her name is Barbara Tuchman, T-U-C-H-M-A-N. And what she does in that book, and I'll tell you real quickly the history of the book. She writes the history of the Balfour Declaration. Now, the Balfour Declaration was instituted by His Majesty's government in 1917, and it declared that after the First World War, that His Majesty's government looked with favor upon the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish people in their ancient state of Israel. And so it, now I could get into it rather deeply, but you taught that here, didn't you? Well... Yeah, you did the, yeah. But at any rate, the point is that she, and she's an unbeliever, she's a very competent historian, she's no longer with us. She, by the way, never got any sort of degree in history. She was a housewife who got interested in these things. She wrote a book called The Guns of August, which is the basic, kind of the go-to book on the origins of the First World War and so on. She's a very well-respected historian. And she's very Jewish, and she had an ancestor who was actually pivotal to the whole, all the political scenario that was going on when the Balfour Declaration was made in 1917. But the point is, she traces the historical events and personages which eventuated in the Balfour Declaration, and thus... in the rebirth of the state of Israel. And she, by the way, this is not what I came to talk about, but there simply has never been a more stunning, and this happened basically in our lifetime, certainly in our era, and there has never been I wonder, maybe the book of Esther, this rivals the book of Esther in terms of a set of absolutely unthinkable providential strokes which eventuated in God's purposes being fulfilled. The rebirth of the state of Israel could not happen. One of the most, I think, intriguing parts of this book that our seminary published, and a couple of you have worked your way through and so on, is the chapter where he has a sermon by a preacher, what was that guy's name, in the 1850s, where he simply goes to the scriptures and deduces, he interprets them rightly to understand that Israel is going to be reborn as a state. Now, most of us never do anything different. And you look at a map and there's Israel, of course. It's absolutely impossible to overstate how impossible, how absolutely unthinkable it was that Israel would ever be reborn. Now, what got me thinking about that was this idea that God has, in creation, God shaped the world in such a way that Israel would be at the center of the nations and that the news of what he was doing in Israel would be carried to various parts of the world. What Tuchman does, she doesn't set out to do this, but in my reading of her, is she shows how God continued to, in again, discernible, if remarkable, providential ways, continued. He contrived so that Israel would continue in every age to be sort of the same. It is today. That's all we think about. You know, and every statesman, especially here in the state, they think if we could find a way to settle the problem in Israel, we'd be famous forever. And it's just she goes through, I won't go any further with it, but it's a really, and I'll tell you something. She makes this point two or three times because she traces, you know where she starts? The King James Bible. And basically the Bible being translated into English and the English-speaking Christian world making the startling discovery that Israel was part of God's plan. As you started to read the Old Testament. And she posits especially, she credits, I should say, especially the King James, because it was such, and it is, beautiful English. It will never be matched in terms of just beautiful, beautiful English. I was reared on it. I memorized all my verses in it. But I still, every morning, listen to the King James. I like to listen to the Bible, and I listen to the King James. It's just so sonorous. But at any rate, the point is, she starts there, and then she goes through all these episodes and so on. She goes through the significant personnel, the Herzl and the Weizmann and so on, Balfour and so on. She traces it, and it's so much fun to read from my mind. I read it every 5 or 6 years, actually. But here's what the point is. She makes the point again and again. She says, as I unfold, we look back and we look at history, we see how this set the scene for this, and that set the scene for this. And ultimately, what was produced was the Balfour Declaration, which was enacted by the nascent and, ill-conceived League of Nations into law in 1922. And therefore, you realize the state of Israel, I think it's fair to say, is the only state on the face of the earth that's ever been called into existence by the vote of the community of nations across the world. And we say that they have no right to it. Good heavens. All right, Bookman, get off of them. My point is, she says that, as I trace this, don't get the idea that with each one of these events or individuals, the possibility became greater that there would be a state of Israel. It didn't. With every one of them, it became more unthinkable, more impossible. But there she sits. Now, what's that got to do with anything? I can't remember. But, no, what I'm saying is that in the Old Testament, it's kind of easy to identify very specifically the strategy that God used to make Israel the center of everybody's attention, and it was simple geography, that the caravans are going to be forced through there, and almost every of those significant, not caravans, there were all sorts of trading parties and so on. Some were big, some were small. They all had a small security, or a significant security force. That's why you formed a caravan. But nonetheless, so many of them had these heralds attached to them, and they were looking for good stories to tell. And let me tell you something, they heard those stories in Israel, and people across the world wanted to hear those stories, not only and probably not primarily because they were interested in the God of Israel, but because Israel was so pivotal. It was such a such a pivotal place in all the events of the world and so on. So even the possibility that they're going to get their goods delivered them through them because they can get through there. So all right, so that's my point. That God raised up Israel, the intent and importance of Israel's influence was that Israel would be a light to the nations. But how is God going to do that? He providentially shaped the earth so that they would function as a kingdom with a priestly capacity or function. On the other hand, he also said that I'm going to make you a kingdom of priests and a holy or set-apart nation. Now, as long as I'm, it's book report night, let me recommend another book to you by my all-time favorite author, whose name is Herman Woke. I've talked to you about this before, I think. I love Woke, anything you can get by Yoke. Well, almost anything. W-O-U-K, Herman Woke, W-O-U-K. Tremendous author, but he wrote a book called This Is My God. And it's the most winsome, and Woke is the greatest wordmaster I ever read, wordsmith. Hey, he's peerless in my humble estimation. But so he's fun to read. But his story is this. He was raised in a very Jewish home in I believe it was Brooklyn. When he was about 8 years old, his grandfather, who spoke absolutely no English, came from Russia and moved in with him. He talks about a Sabbath morning when he when he was kind of not altogether gently jerked out of bed by his grandfather and walked into the kitchen and sat down, and his grandfather took a tome and set it on the table and said the one word he knew in English, read. And that's how he started to study Talmud. So he just woke just, he's very, very Jewish, but he was in the Army for a time, and in the Navy, actually. He wrote Cain Mutiny. Remember Cain Mutiny with General Philip Quigg and the three balls and all that sort of stuff? You know what I'm talking about? It's a very, very good movie and so on, very good story. But here's the point. I'm jabbering. He went to Columbia University, and then he went out to Hollywood, very nice, and this is in the 50s, to be a gag writer for one of the comedians. I can't say his name all of a sudden, but one of the standard, very early comedians. And the guy who used to have the argument with Jack Benny all the time. They were always pretended they were enemies. You know who I'm talking about? But at any rate, he had been raised to be very Jewish. And he realized, woke did, that his life was going to be different than all of his fellows. You know, he was, you know, this young college graduate, and they're out there and they're kind of living the life. But he said, if I was going to live my Judaism, every time I sat down to eat with anybody, I was going to have to kind of announce, you know what, I'm Jewish. And every time I was invited to anything on the weekend, I was going to have to say, you know what, I'm Jewish. And he really had a bit of a struggle. He kind of had a life crisis, as he describes it, and he wanted to decide. And he finally came to the commitment, I think a noble commitment, that he was going to honor his Jewish heritage. But he wanted his fellows to understand why, and so he wrote this book to explain Judaism to his goy friends. That makes sense to you? And he just explains Judaism, the feasts and the some history and the synagogue, and it's so much fun. It's really a good way to get in touch with Jewish life. It's fun. But I mention it because, and by the way, he wrote that as a young man, I think in his mid-20s. He lived to be well over 100, and he, late in his life, I think in his 90s, he looked back on that decision, and he wrote the other bookend, and he called it The Will to Live On. I mean, it's just kind of an interesting thing. Guy makes that kind of decision, lives 90 years, looks back, and it kind of assesses it and so on. But that's another thing. He makes the point in that book. He says, you know, if you many of the dietary laws, for instance, of the Old Testament, seem to have some sort of salutary, salubrious, health-giving dynamic, right? It's hard to get all those little crawly things out of the pork. Let's just admit it, even as we chow down on the bacon, right? But you know, he says, yes, there's certainly wisdom in a day of rest every 7 days and so on. And there was a guy, anybody remember this guy named S.I. McMillan, who wrote a book called None of These Diseases? And it was kind of an interesting book, and he showed how, in so many ways, not only the dietary requirements, many elements of the law were health-giving. And Woke acknowledges that. But he says, but don't get the idea that that's really what the law is all about. Why all those restrictions? Those restrictions were designed by God to make you different. So the Jews stood out to the degree that they honored that law, whether it be the Hasids with the, and of course so much of what distinguishes Jews today, the yarmulke and sometimes the earlocks, you know, the earlocks and so on. That's not entirely biblical. Most of that is rabbinic. That's tradition. But nonetheless, this idea that I'm going back to Woke. Every time he'd sit down to eat, he'd have to more or less announce, I'm Jewish. And so my point is that God intended that Israel be distinct from other nations in order that they might bear that testimony. Does that make sense to you? Now, let me go back to geography, because this dynamic of distinctive divisions. All right, now you're going to get about 10 minutes of pure mind-numbing geography, okay? So hold on for dear life here. But everybody who goes to Israel, and some of you have been with me, I think you will acknowledge that you're struck, no matter how much you're told, you're struck at how small it is And yet, how absolutely distinct the divisions are. We frame our trips when Dave and I go, and so we frame our trips to make sure we get each division and that we stress the distinctive of each geography. And when I say division, geography, topography, weather, agriculture, remarkable distinctions. Well, there's design in that. There's a purpose in that. So let me walk you through it. Here is there are these five divisions from west, from the Mediterranean working east. And I list them there for you. Let me just take you through them. First of all, there is the coastal plains. Now, it's just exactly what it sounds like. And this is, by the way, what geographers call the Via Maris. This is the section of that international highway called that crosses the Fertile Crescent that goes down the coastal plain. This is the easy traveling and so on. Here's a topographical map, and the coastal plains kind of color them in there. You see where I'm talking? By the way, let me take you back just a bit. This, see if I can do this. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get away with this, but I'm going to try it. This, here's the coastal plains. Is it going to let me do it? Yeah. But this right here is also the coastal plains. That's a little not real well done. That's the Jezreel Valley. That's that valley that we talked about yesterday. That valley, and again, there is such importance in this, but it's for yesterday. That valley is part of the coastal plains, but there is this bulge called Mount Carmel, this finger that sticks out right in the middle of it that makes it the choke point. And so, at any rate, the coastal plains are basically along the Mediterranean Sea and then the valley of Jezreel. Now, here are some pictures, but that's exactly what you would expect. This is looking out on the coastal plains down toward, actually north toward Tel Aviv, across the coastal plains. Oh, my goodness. I've done you a disservice. Hold on here. How do I get back from that thing? Hold on here. Now you've got my display view. I wanted to... Okay. No. All right, here we go again. Yeah, I know what I'm doing, but I disguise it well. All right, now I can go display settings, duplicate slideshow. Now we both got that picture. There we go. This is all the coastal plains. It's just that. It's flat. It's largely traversable, so you can travel it and so on. So you have the coastal plains. By the way, might I just say, that this is some of the most beautiful farmland on the face of the earth. But after the Apostolic Age, of course, you have the Roman period, then you have the Byzantine period, and then the Muslims. You have the Arab periods. And then the brief Crusades in the 12th century, and then the more Arab control, and finally for 400 years from 1517 to 2017, those are the dates. You have the Ottoman Turkish period, and during that period, the land of Israel was destroyed. The land was destroyed. Now, curiously, this is exactly what, not just curiously, this is exactly what God said would happen, that the land would become a desolation. And the primary means by which that happened was the horrible abuse of the land and the people by the Ottoman Turks. And the Ottoman Turks abused the land in many different ways. In one way was that, for instance, you got to understand, for those years, and we're going back to, this is why I say, the idea that Israel could be reborn as a healthy state was just unthinkable, especially in the 18th century, the 1700s, because the Ottoman Turks, you got to understand, they conquered the land, and they had these overlords who had great tracts of property. Now, they didn't live there. They lived in Istanbul or Alexandria or Cairo or whatever, but they had land agents who patrolled it and so on. And then you had these squatters who would try and eke a living, and they would come and abuse them and tax them and so on. One of the things they did, the Ottoman Turkish overlords is they put a tax on the trees. You would pay a tax for every tree you had on your property. Well, what are you going to do? Now what's going to happen? All the soil is swept away. So this land, which in the Old Testament is described as a land of milk and honey, and there are various ways that that's understood, but it certainly means fruitful, for heaven's sakes, and it became desolate beyond almost, I mean, beyond what you can imagine. Now, one of the best expressions of this is Mark Twain in his 1850s, what did he call it, his travel book, Innocents Abroad, where he describes traveling through Israel, and he just goes on about how totally desolate, and these little tiny villages, and no water, and you can go for miles and never see a person, and nothing will grow, and it's just, and he bemoans the fact that this land, which was so celebrated in the days of the Bible, is totally, totally, and he would argue irreparably desolate. And yet God also promised that he was going to bring it back. And he has done it. Now, this area that we're considering, the coastal plains, look at that, just all sorts of, and the primary, I think, but one of the primary agricultural products that is produced all across the coastal plain is flowers. Some of the best soil and the best water, the best ecology for flowers. And it's one of their top exports. I was Israel ships tulips to Holland every year, and it's marvelous. But it's all recovered land. That's what I was going to say to you. This is the Valley of Jezreel itself. There's Megiddo. I got some things stuck in here. We are standing near where Saul fell on his sword, and looking across to where the Philistines were gathered there on Mount Gilboa yonder. But so that's the coastal plains. Now let me just say this, that by reason of the abuse of the land and so on, this area, especially to the north, was almost entirely swampland. And in the early days of the Zionist movement, and let me just say, I am a Christian Zionist simply because I believe Israel has both a biblical, political, and historical right to that property. But I have no illusions about Zionism. Zionism, dreamed up in the mind of Theodore Herzl, 1897, the First Congress, and so on. It was one of the most godless. It was thoroughly communistic. We're coming right out of the Bolshevik Revolution, and the Zionists who came to restore the land were totally, totally Marxist. I mean, they were serious about it, and they were going to do it right. But God used that. I mean, but what would happen is that and of course it was because of these assaults on Jews across the world. There were several aliyahs, several times where Jews came back, and one of them was because of the Tsarist persecution. That's Fiddler on the Roof. That's the story. If you like that story, what's happened is they're fleeing because of those pogroms, and then many of them came to Israel and so on. But the point is that there were these wealthy Jewish financiers and philanthropists, the Morgenthaus and the Montefiores and the Rockefellers and so on, and they would go to those owners. They would send their agents to the owners of these great tracts of land, and they would very carefully and at exorbitant prices, they would buy a portion of land. And then they would recruit these refugees, often with nothing but literally the clothes and a back, and they would bring them there, and they would start a community called kibbutz, and they had a strategy called the tower and the stockade, and they would have it all set up, and they know exactly now you got to understand. It's not like you go down to the town hall and pull out the plat books and find it. You know, this is just, you work out, these are the boundaries and so on. You pay a horrible price. Now, the people who are living there, they don't know anything about this. All of a sudden, they get up one day, and there's this hill over here that was nothing there yesterday. And they get up in the morning, and there's a fence with a tower in the middle, a tower and a stockade. And then they begin to work the land. And it's absolutely stunning. But what they had to do in the coastal plains, because they were malaria-ridden, alligator-infested swamps. And in almost every case, when those refugees would show up to claim that land, which had been duly purchased, it was totally unlivable. And it was very much like the pilgrims coming to America. The first generation, over half of them died the first year. But more came. And they worked at it, and they drained those swamps, and literal swamps and literal draining. It was curious. Number one, they dynamited. I won't get into it, but there's a certain sea creature that kind of, because of the secretions, it dams up and it doesn't flow. And so they figured that out, and they dynamited that, and they dug channels so that the water could flow out into the Mediterranean Sea. And the other thing that curiously is they went to, I think it was Australia, and they got eucalyptus trees. And they planted a lot of eucalyptus trees. And you go to Israel today, eucalyptus trees all over the place. Because eucalyptus trees draw an amazing amount of water out of the soil. Ah, but what they found out decades later was that those eucalyptus trees sunk their roots really deep. And so they were really drawing it out of the aquifer. And not the surface water that they hoped. So now they're trying to get rid of them because they need the water. It's kind of backfired on them. But nonetheless, they were able to reclaim thousands of acres of this beautiful farmland. And I always make this point. Some of you remember, as we start out on Monday morning and make our way across here, that you're looking at some of them with beautiful farmland. But understand that if your great-grandparents had come through here, it would have been a totally desolate wilderness. And both of those were prophesied by God. That is, it's going to become desolate, but I'm going those. Remember Ezekiel and the dry bones? He hears the noise and the bones begin to. And it's interesting that those bones, remember the dry bones, and they come together and they stand up. But Ezekiel says, but there is no spirit in them. So that's yet to come. That's the tribulation period. That's how God is going to put His Spirit, Ezekiel 36, into 37, into those bones. All right, I lose my way, don't I? But so that's the coastal plains, and very important. There's a lot more we could say about it, but let me take you. Then you have a little area that most people neglect, but it's hugely important. I mean, when you're talking about the geography, it's called the Shvelah, and the Shvelah is a region of low. It's the Shvelah means under or beneath or low, and it's a region of foothills and a Piedmont, as it were. And it's very, very important for reasons I'm not going to get into right now. I'll just say very simply that the Shvelah is. I always tell my students, when you think of the Shvelah, think of a buffer, because it is two times a buffer. Number one, it catches the rainwater coming out of the hills so that it doesn't flood the plain. There's only a Shvelah in the south, not in the north. And so the northern coastal plain swamped awfully, but the southern, have you ever noticed? Now think about in your own mind, a Bible map. You can do a little bit of this. Remember the five Philistine cities on the coastal plain? Where are they? They're all in the south, because that's where you could live. But the northern area tended to swamp. So it was a buffer because it caught the rainwater. But then secondly, in order to attack, see, because Jerusalem sits right here. And in order to attack Jerusalem, number one, if you're going to come, and most of the armies are going to come from the east, so they're going to come down, you have to follow the crescent, they're going to come down this way. And they can't, they don't want anything to do with this rift. So they're not going to go in the rift. And so they can't attack Jerusalem from the east. And the road getting down in the hill country is so narrow that you can't attack them from the north. So you're going to have to, and this is as true, this is exactly what happened in 1967. This is how the IDF took Jerusalem in 1967. They had to follow these roads. And so they weren't coming from the north, but you're going to have to come down the Via Maris. You're going to have to bring your army and your equipment down the coastal plain and then attack Jerusalem from the west. So, if you want to fortify Jerusalem, where do you build your fortified cities? In the Shvelah. That make sense to you? It's huge to a lot of Bible stories. One of the fortified cities is Lachish. I'd love to talk to you about Lachish. But another was Gezer and Azekah. So at any rate, I won't give you any more geography than that. But the Shvela is very important region in terms of just understanding a lot of dynamics of biblical history. But then, oh, and here's the Shvela. Now the Shvela is low rolling hills. Geographers, I warned you I was going to talk geography. Geographers, and I'm not really a geographer, but I spend time with Bible geography. Matter of fact, I'm going to tell you everything I know right now and make up a few things. So don't ask me no questions. Geographers like to refer to regions as either open or closed. And an open region simply means you can put a road most anywhere. Closed is Seattle, right? Open is Indiana, for heaven's sake. You know, straight roads every mile, you know what I'm saying? But and the Shvela is quite open. The hills are navigable. They're kind of undulating hillsides. They're low and so on. Now, in this, I'll show you better. So this is the Shvela. This is it has broad valleys. Now, what's the importance of a broad valley? You can plant grain in that valley. Remember, everybody has to worry about where you're going to get your grain. If you live in a region where you get these broad valleys, that's huge. Now, here's a nice picture in this terms, because this is the Shvela. This is the Elah Valley where David battled Goliath. But notice back here, you see that? Those higher hills behind? That's the hill country. So beyond the Shvela is the central hill country. That's where we're going next. You see the contrast there. All right, so, and there's another nice one. So there's the Shvela in front of us. The road can kind of make its way quite easily across it. As a matter of fact, the main road in the Shvela is called the diagonal road because it just starts down here and goes up, you know, kind of like a diagonal. But in the far, you can see in the distance those much higher and more rugged hills of the central hill country. We're going to come to that. So here's the Shvela. All right, so that's the Shvela. The third region and the one with which you are probably most familiar because most of the geography or the Bible happens here is what's called the central hill country. And it is like a spine running up and down, and it's very, well, here it is. This is sort of the central hill country. And especially in the south where Jerusalem is, not nearly so much in the north where Galilee is, but it is very, very rugged. Now, the thing about the hill country is it's some of the toughest terrain on earth to actually live on. I mean, it really is. Number one, it's characterized by these steep hillsides that are, and well, almost all of Israel is limestone. And limestone is a sedimentary rock. In other words, it was laid down after the flood. It was laid down in layers. Well, when the mountains were upthrust after the flood, it produces these natural terraces. Now, what that means is, you can't just make your way down in the Shvela. You can just walk over the hill. Here, especially, I mean, maybe if you're a 14-year-old kid, okay. But if you got a cart, see the point? It's really a closed area. Travel is very, very difficult. Here again, can you see the natural terraces? I know it's a little dim, but notice the narrow valley. Somebody see the green right in the middle there? Somebody bought that up, and they got some grain down there. They're trying to make use of what they got, but there are very few. They tend to be V-shaped valleys as opposed to broad valleys, steep hillsides, terraced, and thus it is very hard to travel. And so what you have to do is you have to travel the ridges. You have to stay up on the ridges. Sometimes they'll dip into a valley. You've got to find the ridges at the top of the hill. And most of the ridges don't go anywhere. Most of them are cul-de-sacs. You just have to come back. So there's just a very narrow, and there is a road that from the north to the south, from the Jezreel Valley, Dothan, down through Shechem and Shiloh and Gibeah and Bethlehem. Jerusalem is just off of it, and Hebron and Beersheba. That winds back and forth, you know. That's called the Central Ridge Route. It's also called the Water Parting Route. You can see why. You know, you're at the top of the ridge, and so the water that falls, some of it's going to go to the Jericho, to the Jordan, and some of it's going to go to the Mediterranean. It's also called the Way of the Patriarchs to this day. And we travel when you're in Israel. Now, Israel's gotten creative, and some we dropped down on the shoulder. But basically, a lot of the travel we do, they call it the Hebron Road because it goes down to Hebron. And it's the same road today that it was in the days of the patriarchs. It's the way the land is built. It's so closed, you have to follow those ridges. All right, so also, well, like I said, this is a valley just outside of Jerusalem. Now, these hillsides, well, I'll come back to it later. It's hard to see, but these are very, very typical scenes in the hill country. Does that make sense to you? I'm boring the snot out of you, but I'm telling you, folks, I'm going to make this important in a minute, okay? Here's Tel Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom. Marvelous, marvelous city. But, again, more of the same. I got some pictures here. Now, here we are in Jerusalem, and you can hardly see it. Jerusalem sits almost atop the hill country. So Jerusalem is very much a part of the hill country. And here we're standing in the south and looking to the north, and you can't see it very well, but this is the Temple Mount right here. And the city of Jerusalem spreads up the hill this way. But at any rate, even there, you can see the steep hills and so on. So that's the central hill country. Now beyond that is one of the most dramatic, it's not beautiful, so it's not the Grand Canyon, but it is one of the most dramatic geological phenomena on the face of the earth, and that is the Jordan Rift. Now, the Jordan Rift is actually, it runs north to south. It begins in Lebanon, between the Lebanon and Lebanon Mountains, and it travels south all the way. It's called the Syro, as in Syria, African Rift, because it goes all the way to Central Africa. And anybody remember, we used to have missionaries, First Baptist Church of Rockford, Illinois, and some of our missionaries taught at the Rift Valley Academy. Anybody ever hear of the Rift Valley Academy in Congo? Same rift. Now, it's about a quarter of the Earth's circumference, and it's a gouge at its lowest point, and it's never so low as it is in Israel. But here, on the east of Israel, you have the lowest spot in America is what? How low? Do you know? I happen to know. 282 feet. That's what I've read. 282 feet below sea level, Death Valley, California. The deepest spot anywhere else on Earth, somewhere in Asia, is just over 400 feet deep, as I remember. The Jordan Rift starts up here in, I wish this was a little clear, but it starts up here to the north and comes down through the Hula Valley, and then you have the Sea of Galilee. That's in the rift. And then you have the Jordan River. Jordan River flows out of the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea, right? Everybody remember that? The Sea of Galilee on its is about 600 feet below sea level. Now remember, deepest spot anywhere else on the earth is in 400 feet. It's 600 feet below sea level, but it continues to drop, and the surface of the Dead Sea is 1,300 feet below sea level, and the Dead Sea at one point is 1,200 feet deep. So you've got just a mammoth gouge in the face of the earth. And really, this Jordan Rift, now it continues to the south, the Arabah, and then rises up and makes its way all the way down to Central Africa, but again, it's impossible to overstate the impact of the Jordan Rift. And basically, the way it impacts is you don't want to go there for any number of reasons, especially a caravan. You don't want to go down there. And that's why the traffic is going to be forced into the Jezreel Valley. Does that make sense to you? It's going to be funneled over there because you don't want anything to do with the Jordan Rift. Now, it's interesting, by the way, that, you know, we mentioned the Nile and Egypt and Mesopotamia, the Tigris and Euphrates, and generally with in any country, when you've got a long river, especially the entire nation, life is going to kind of build around that river, and that's going to, you know, never in Israel. The Jordan River is not attractive. It's when it enters the narrative, it's usually just a barrier. We got to work our way around it, and so on. And the reason is, it's because it's at the bottom of the Jordan Rift. So it's not good for irrigation. What are you going to do? You can't grow much down. They do. I shouldn't say that. But you certainly can't irrigate the country. You can't get it out of there. And it's a very unusual river. Let's put it that way. I won't go any further with it other than the Jordan Rift. Well, here it is. Jordan Rift is, let's try and color it in a little bit, but it is just that. It's this remarkable deep cleft in the face of the earth. It's tectonic plates. Israel gets a lot of earthquakes. They get, once every 24 days they get a significant registers on their, seismic instruments and so on. And, but anyway, because they sit on Eat Your Heart Out, California, the deepest fault line in the face of the earth. Now, interestingly enough, to the north, all right, real quickly, to the north is a mountain called, it's the southern reach of the Anti-Lebanon Mountains called Mount Hermon. And it's a true blue, no kidding around muscle, mountain. I was going to say muscled up mountain, but it's 9,000 feet, but in Israel it's 7,000 feet. And it's snow every year. They get 50 feet or more of snow. That snowfall is the primary source of the Jordan River because it trickles out, it gushes out four springs at the base of Mount Hermon. One of them is Caesarea Philippi. Remember, Jesus goes to Caesarea Philippi? Another, the big one, is Dan. Remember, the Danites go up and settle at Dan? That's one of those springs. And those four springs form the Jordan River system. And they flow down until you get this bulge called the Sea of Galilee, and then they keep flowing down to the Sea of Dead Sea. Now, I think you know that the Dead Sea is dead because it has no outlet. You remember the figure? I think 7 million tons, I'm pretty sure about this, of water flow into the Dead Sea every day. Now, these statistics are probably old because the Dead Sea's in deep trouble because the water's being drained off. But nonetheless, we used to say that 7 million tons of water flow into the Dead Sea every day, and 7 million tons evaporate. So the only way for water to escape the Dead Sea is by evaporation, and it leaves behind salt, minerals. They say there's mineral wealth beyond measure in the Dead Sea if they knew how to get it out. They extract a lot of it in, but then, of course, the salt. Seawater is what, I think 4 to 6% salt, something like that. The Dead Sea is 25 to 36%, I think, percent. It's really a phenomenon. And but anyway, I'll just leave it alone. The point is that I don't remember what my point was, but let me. I know. I was going to say that when you think of the Jordan Rift, you'll often think, and appropriately enough, of the Jeshimon, that area where Jesus went to be tempted and so on, and then Masada and Jericho, and it's dry. And well, it starts up here in the north, and those four springs are feeding the Jordan River, and you get rushing rivers like this. This is way up, this is the Jordan River, north of the Sea of Galilee. And but then you flow down, this is Beit Shan, for what it's worth. I don't know why I got that. But this is kind of what you think of. And you know, this area, let me show you something. This area on the west of the Dead Sea, I'm just going to use this map. Can you see it at all? You see, here is the Arabian Desert. And I'm going to come to this in a minute, but for 6 months of the year, Israel gets all of her weather off the Arabian Desert. So you get this east wind blowing across. In the Bible, an east wind is another word for misery. If there's an east wind blowing in your life, you're having a miserable day. And because when that east wind blows off the Arabian Desert, it's hot, it's heavy, it's miserable, and so on. Well, for 6 months of the year, you get this hot wind blowing across the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea has so much salt that it saturates the air. People every day, every time I've been to the Dead Sea, as you go down there, we usually go down there in the evening, and there are people who have driven out just to take pictures. Because that ambiance, that salty air produces the most amazing sunsets and these colors you can't imagine, like rainbow colors many times. But at any rate, so you got that salt-saturated atmosphere and as hot wind, and it bakes this area right here on the western side of the Dead Sea. And it produces what is called the wilderness. So when you have David fleeing from Saul in the wilderness, And you really have to kind of rethink this, because when we think of a wilderness, we kind of think of maybe a jungle. We raised our kids on a book, I don't know, Ken Taylor's The Bible in Pictures for Little Eyes. Anybody ever see that book? But, you know, I don't know why. We got that book and we'd read it to our kids. We went to a couple of them. And I just remember that they had a little story, you know, a little picture and a little story about Jesus' temptation and Jesus sitting on a rock with a banana tree over him, you know, and monkeys and so on. And because that's what we think of when we think of a wilderness. Well, that misses the point, see, because this is the wilderness. That's what you're looking at, that you're in this deep, deep rift. And now as you go to the west toward the Mediterranean, it rises up very steeply and very high. You're at probably about 900 feet below sea level by the time you get there. And it's just baked. And it's, more than anything else, it's like a moonscape. And it's hot and dry and miserable and forbidding and so on. This is where Jesus goes, to the wilderness. Now, the biblical word is Jeshimon, but what do you care? It's really pivotal to a lot of biblical narratives, because this is the way I tell it when we're there. Because I would say there were three kinds of people who might find their way to the wilderness. One is religious recluses, like the Essenes. Remember, Qumran is right down here. They want to get alone. You want yourself. Another person who goes off for solitude is Jesus. That's why he goes down here. Oh, I'd love to talk to you about it. But, I mean, I think there's more to it. But I'll just say this. Think about the contrast between the temptation of the first Adam and the temptation of the last Adam. In the temptation of the first Adam, God was gracious and careful to surround Adam with every possible advantage. Everything he could long for, need, all provided for him, right? In the temptation of the last Adam, God was careful to put him at every conceivable disadvantage. So he goes down to one of the loneliest, most forlorn places on earth. He's absolutely alone. He fasts for 40 days, so at the very edge of physical death. And yet he trusts God, trusts God's word. So it was the Jeshimon, the wilderness was important. And what's interesting is it's so close. Jerusalem, and I'm going to say this in a minute, Israel in the main gets plenty of water. Jerusalem gets has a higher average rainfall than London. But Jerusalem is in the hills. And so that water runs off so quickly, you can't say, but you leave Jerusalem. And we do this. We go to Jerusalem. We go on the east side of Jerusalem. There's the Mount of Olives. Four times the Old Testament talks about a mountain which lies on the east of Jerusalem. That's the Mount of Olives. Runs north and south. It's about 2,700 feet high. But you stand there and you look to the west, and there's the city of Jerusalem. And honestly, it's green trees, you know, tops. You turn around and look to the east, and it's dry as a bone. They get about 27 inches of rain in Jerusalem. You look down there at the descending, you're looking down the hill toward the Jordan Rift. And down there, because right at the bottom of that hill is Jericho, they get about 5 inches of rain. So they're about 17 miles apart. And all of that's, and so what I'm saying is that you have, this is what I'm saying, with these remarkable distinctions that are right on top of each other. But this horribly desolate and forlorn spot called the wilderness is so accessible. So when David goes to fetch the, remember when he's fleeing from Saul and he goes to Nob and he gets the sword and the bread and so on, he heads for the wilderness because there are places to hide. And you know what? Down there in the wilderness, as dry as it is, there are scrub grass that the sheep, but more importantly, the goats love. And so David lived at the right, Bethlehem is right at the top of that. So he had spent a lot of time down there as a boy. So he knew that wilderness. And he could go down there, even with his mighty men and so on, gather them to himself. He'd go down there. So that's the second point. First of all, a religious recluse would find his way to the wilderness. Secondly, a fugitive, somebody who's on the run, could make his way down to the... And that's David. He spends a lot of time escaping, you know, fleeing from Saul. And, frankly, the third type of person who might make his way down to the wilderness is a rebel, a seditionist, somebody who wants to mount and that's Masada. That's where the rebels, you remember, hide and so on. So that wilderness, as I'm taking you, is here, by the way, here we're looking across the Dead Sea. That's Jordan. on the opposite side of the sea there. Here's more of the wilderness. Oh, I'm going backwards. It looked a lot like the last one. And this is cave 4 at Qumran. This is one of the caves where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. But just look at the desolate. This is En Gedi. This is a little spring that comes charging out. I can explain to you why. And you remember David in 1 Samuel 27. He's in the spring at En Gedi. And he's watering his animals and so on, fleeing from Saul. That's Masada. Can you see it in the background there? That's Masada looking across the Dead Sea. So again, I like that shot. That kind of gives you a picture for the beauty and the desolation all at once of the Jordan Rift. So I'm telling you, the Jordan Rift is, I've already said it, I guess, but it just really, in so many ways, defines the narrative of the Old Testament. All right. Man, 7:30. All right. Then you have the Transjordanian Plateau. I'm going to make my point, and we're going to take a break. Watch this. What? So what? There's the Transjordanian Plateau, and it's important, and 2.5 tribes settled over there, and there was a major highway over there, and I can go on and on. But most of the life was between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, the Old Testament. Now watch. Here's my point. So I like Bible geography, and I just imposed it upon you. But why is it important? Well, as I say there, though military and commercial traffic was I'll say it this way. Everybody who studies the land of Israel says that one of the most important and remarkable dynamics of that little tiny land is that it is at once so public and so private. That's the word they'll use. Almost every Bible geography book you look at, so public and so private. Why was it public? Because it was the choke point in international highway. So here are basically the highways. That is, you have the Via Maris, and that's coming down this is the Via Maris, and this is the King's Highway over here. It's not quite as important, but those are both, it is very important to the spice trade and so on, but those are both very, every day, caravans, any army or military force is going to make its way, it's going to follow those roads. Ah, but on the other hand, Israel lived in, I'll tell you, those armies didn't want anything to do with that hill country. Maybe I said to you before, I use this line all the time, that the land of Israel is like one big paintball arcade. Did I tell you that? It's just made for guerrilla warfare. And armies didn't want to go up there. They could send their scouts, but they'd never clean out all the ambushes and so on. So they wanted to stay down there where they belonged. Unless they wanted to conquer Jordan, then they have to find a way to get up there. But that comes late in the Old Testament. So you've got all of this traffic, and Israel lives up there. Because Jerusalem, again, I don't have it here, but Jerusalem is right here. So they live up in the hills. And so the point is that, again, there I did it again, I guess. But here come the primary international highways. Do we have one more, Bookman? Oh, there it comes. Yeah, okay. But Israel lives in that hill country. It's not pleasant. It's hard living. There's no doubt about it. But by the same token, they had remarkable security so that they could live. They could be a set-apart nation. You see what I'm saying to you? So you've got the shape of the earth by which God contrives to make Israel a kingdom with a priestly function, carrying the message all over the world. But you got the shape of the land, by which God contrives to give Israel remarkable privacy and security as she lives up on those very difficult highlands. And can, there's the temple, and they can worship their God and so on. Now, they're careless about it, no doubt about it. But it's in that way that, so I go back to it. The intent and importance of Israel's influence, God raised him up to be his witness to the nations. How's he going to do that? Well, through his dealings with that little nation, he's going to put on display his care and his love, or his justice and his wrath. And in either case, those stories are going to be carried to the ends of the earth by reason of the shape of the earth. But by the same token, because they have to be a set-apart people in so many different ways, including their law, we'll come back to that after the break, in point of fact, they can live in remarkable security. All right, now does that make sense to you? It's biblical. I'm not making anything up. Now think, how does that compare to your life bearing the witness to God in Plainfield, Indiana? Wouldn't you say this is a different set of strategies? what's going on in the Old Testament is very different. That's what I'm saying to you. I think it's pretty undeniable. All right, let's take a break. And I'll be back in about a quarter till, something like that, when we yell at you.